Lifetimes of Listening.
I mean, there's times I just listen to that and just cry by myself, you know?
George and Ira Gershwin have my entire heart.
And he put on Rhapsody in Blue, and I just was taken over by that music.
I mean, I think everyone in my family has a very large variety of the type of music we listen to.
I guess a lot of these songs bring up the connotation of freedom for me, like expansiveness.
Lifetimes of Listening.
This is Lifetimes of Listening, the Arizona Musical Memory Podcast, an outgrowth of the Arizona Musical Memory Archive. I'm Brian Moon, an associate professor of practice at the School of Music at the University of Arizona, where I'm the coordinator for music gen ed at the Fred Fox School of Music.
And I'm Dan Cruz. I'm an alum of the University of Arizona School of Music. I'm pretty involved in musical research of various sorts, teaching now and then, documentary work, and an announcer and host on a local public radio station as well. So what's this program all about? Lifetimes of Listening, the Arizona Musical Memory Podcast. Here's a little taste of what to expect in this episode.
My first most profound musical memory, being a child of the 70s and being completely enamored with the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. But also there was this deep emotionality to it that was very soothing and very healing for me.
That's just a brief excerpt of one of the interviews we'll be hearing today on this episode of Lifetimes of Listening. We'll hear more of that really interesting musical memory in just a couple of minutes, and we'll discuss it with a musical scholar who will be our guest and who will reflect on its meaning and significance.
This project and this podcast collects musical memories from people. They tell us their stories and about these experiences with music that have stayed with them over time, and we gather them and post them in a digital archive at Lifetimes of Listening and on the website. And then we collect them and bring them here to the podcast and bring in people with interesting perspectives to help us understand how these musical memories have gained meaning in people's lives.
And speaking of that, coming up in just a minute here, a fascinating conversation with a noted music theorist about different qualities or sounds of aspect of music and how they affect people and people's musical memories in different ways. Stay with us for that. So this episode of Lifetimes of Listening looks at some things about music, and Brian and I, frankly, well, we weren't quite sure how to refer to this, right? Qualities of music, aspects of music.
Musical elements, sounds. It was hard to figure out how to describe this, but we are aware that many people respond to music and have these rich musical memories associated with some aspect of the sound and the way that they're perceiving the sound in a moment. So we were trying to come up with a term that encapsulates all of those types of reactions. I'm not sure that we've
settled
on it.
I'm not sure we have either.
Right? Yeah.
But it's something about the sounds of music and certain aspects of the sounds of music that people respond to in very pronounced ways. And those are the basis for the musical memories we're going to share today, right?
Right. Could you have an example of that that'll help us get a sense for it?
I do. When I was a teenager, this is a kind of a wacky story. My friend Ken and I were on his front porch, and we'd been listening to music by Dave Brubeck, who plays, you know, played in all sorts of odd time signatures. And somehow Ken and I got into this idea of, how about if you tried to play in 5/4 and 3/4 at the same time, and you put 5/3, what would that sound like? And we did this odd experiment where we realized that the common denominator between 5 and 3 would be 15. So if you took 15 of the slats on his front porch and divided it into a group of 5 and a group of 3, and then put a beat on each of the 1, the 6, the 11, the 1, the 4, the 8, you get where I'm coming from.
Yeah, yeah.
What would that sound like? And somehow we came up out of that with what 5/3 sounds like, which, by the way, is...
You can still do it today.
And that was my introduction to how fascinated I was with this particular aspect of musical sound, which is odd meters and polyrhythms. So that's my story to contribute to the episode today.
Dan, that explains so much to me.
Sure.
About, but this is why you are a drummer. Mm-hmm. You may be a drummer if. Well, I have a very similar kind of experiential sort of thing. I'm a guitarist. And when I was in college, the Indigo Girls, who went to school, one of the Indigo Girls went to the same college that I did. And there was a moment where their song Closer to Fine came out where pretty much if you were strumming guitar around a circle with people, somebody, particularly right here at the school where they were situated and they still regularly performed in coffee shops, somebody would start playing their song Closer to Fine. Closer to Fine uses a C add 2 chord, which guitarists, their fingers already are grabbing it.
Sure.
It's and that was my introduction to add 2 chords that, you know, a major chord that has the second in it up higher so that it rings nicely on a guitar. Hmm. And
some guitars might call it a
C nine,
C add 9 or yes, C plus 9,
different ways to talk about. Music theorists have very strong opinions about it, but this idea of getting into this sound unlocked harmony on the guitar for me in some ways. I found all of the other ways that you could grab a plus 2 chord, and then I started noticing the songs that had that chord. It was a very common chord,
and among them the Indigo Girls.
Indigo Girls, and a lot of guitarists find this chord and use this chord and transition in really interesting ways. And I love the sound of it.
Cool.
And so that's that. I have this strong memory of this discovery of the sound on an instrument, and in songs that stays with me today.
So that sort of experience and that sort of memory is what today's episode of Lifetimes of Listening is all about. And we've got a special guest, Professor Donald Trout, a music theorist at the University of Arizona. And we're going to talk with him a little bit about some musical memories that relate to those special sounds, those special aspects of music that create strong reactions and strong musical memories that we're going to feature on today's podcast. So we're here at the University of Arizona School of Music, and we have a guest for this episode of our Lifetimes of Listening podcast. Our guest is Don Trout, who's a music theorist and a professor of music theory at the University of Arizona. Don, thanks for being with us on the podcast
today. Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your interest in music theory, how that came about, what your areas of expertise, research, maybe publications, sorts of courses you teach, anything that would help us to understand your expertise.
Okay, sure. Well, I got into music theory because I started my undergraduate in Wisconsin. I'm from Wisconsin, and was, you know, planning to be a high school band and or choir director. So, of course, as a music major, I was taking the required courses, music theory among them, and was always quite good at it and encouraged to, you know, do more with it. I eventually changed my major from music ed to Bachelor of Arts in Music Theory. And
was there a particular moment when that kind of
happened? It's funny you should ask. There is there was a very particular moment. The first time as a music ed major, the first time I went to a school to sort of shadow the band director, I wasn't student teaching or anything. I was just sort of hanging around and seeing what being a band director is all about. And he asked me to go help the drums tune their snare drums. Now, I did not know it was possible to tune a snare drum.
How would you know if you weren't a percussionist?
Well, right, exactly. So this consisted of bang, 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 and then crank these things to make sure, I guess, that there's a uniform tension across the drum head. And that, I don't know. I was just, I think I switched majors the next day. It was, you know, and I mean, I have nothing against drums. I love the drums, but it just was an eye-opener to see all of the different elements that I, you know, had never thought of having been in high school band and, interesting, and that kind of thing. So
where do your efforts fall today? What sorts of research have you done? What sorts of courses do you most enjoy teaching?
So I have a research background in the music of Igor Stravinsky. So I've worked on his music for years now, primarily kind of the neoclassic music, where there was this period in his life where he was borrowing music from older styles, Bach, Haydn, Mozart, but making it into a very contemporary 20th century style. So I work on that music a lot and kind of see how old and new come together. I also do work on popular music. So I have studied accent patterns that can be used as hooks. As you know, you and I did an Earworms project together, which was kind of tied to that work as well. And
the idea being that there are certain things about certain types of music that stick in people's heads for long periods of time.
Exactly.
And you
right.
came up with several of those that were very interesting.
I was interested, and that was my role in that project as well. What is it musically about these things that are getting stuck in people's head? That is there something about the music itself that makes them particularly appealing or sticky?
I was fortunate, too, to be invited by you to sit in on a course you taught a few years ago. Was it been 2 or 3 years? Analysis of rock music.
Right.
A graduate-level seminar. And boy, I would have never imagined sitting in a room with a bunch of mostly doctoral students in music theory, how deeply one could go into the analysis of rock music.
Right.
And some of the sophistication that some rock artists, right, songwriters and so forth, bring
exactly
to their
right.
music.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's the, from a theorist's perspective, rock music is just another flavor of tonality. You know, there's Haydn and Mozart, there's jazz repertoire, and there's rock repertoire. And so all of these repertoires are using the same 12 notes and in a lot of ways the same chords, but they're using them in a lot of different ways. So that actually
is partly why we wanted you here today. If you could take some of your expertise at being able to parse out structures of sound and bring them to musical memories. We have noticed as we're collecting and compiling this archive of musical memories that a lot of people are aware of specific aspects of a musical sound, an element, a component that is at the heart of what they're responding to. And we were hoping that we could play some of those for you today.
Right.
And get your opinion about them.
Yeah. Just for background, when we interviewed these three, we didn't go at them with the question, what aspect of music most excites you or do you remember best? We simply said, share a musical memory. And in these three instances, each of them shared something pretty revealing about their own kind of, wow, this about music, this thing about music really has done something for me. It's been a growth step for me or deeper understanding or appreciation of music in some way. So shall we move on to listening to our interviews?
Yes. This first interview you conducted, would you introduce us to Tim?
Yeah, Tim Lohman is a fellow I've known for some years. He's actually a retired professor of physiology here at the University of Arizona. In his late 70s, I believe, and I asked him to share with me a musical memory. He wound up in the course of 20 minutes sharing three or four, and actually they're all encapsulated in this roughly 2-minute musical memory that Tim shared with us. So let's give it a listen and see what Don has to say about this.
I'm Tim Lohman, and I grew up in New Jersey and moved to Illinois, then Arizona. When I was about 16 years old, and my friend Dick Robertson invited me to his house. He had a hi-fi system back in those days, 1957, and he put on Rhapsody in Blue. I just was taken over by that music. It just opened me up to the beauty of music. Another experience 2 years later was I'm a freshman in college. My roommate across the hall pulls out a drawer, and there's a little hi-fi system, record player, and he puts on William Tell Overture. Again, it just penetrates my being. There's not a lot of detail about that. It's just the music itself and its effect on me. And I'm just grateful. Earlier than that, I heard Night and Day, somewhere around fifth grade, sixth grade. I loved that music. Again, that's a certain kind of sound that Cole Porter, Gershwin, a certain kind of harmony that I think really means a lot to me. And then another memory is about Music Man and the Barbershop Quartet and Lila Rose. And again, it's not a one-time thing. It's just incredible harmony of the barbershop guys. It just feels rich. It feels empowering. It feels gratitude. There's a lot of gratitude that I see how enriched I have been by my choices and by carrying music into my life. So I have I just am grateful as I'm talking here, grateful for that listening ability. Yeah. I think they just give me a sense of there's great tragedy in this world and life and suffering, and yet there's great beauty. And it's helped to balance my perception of the world. Take time, I tell myself, to take in the beauty of the world. And it's nature to me, and it's music. The two great beauties.
Any thoughts on that, Don? He covers a lot of ground there.
A lot of ground, yeah, but what a wonderful... what a wonderful story. And obviously that's a very emotionally deep and thoughtful person. I don't know. It just sounds like in his life, he was ready for music to be another way of helping him be in touch with what are clearly, I don't know. He seems like he has a strong heart and a strong emotional connection with himself and with the world around him, and music played into that.
And as well as he can, he's connecting it to something about the harmony that he hears, though he doesn't speak about harmony in technical terms.
Right, the close harmony of the barbershop quartet, or the way that a Cole Porter chord progression kind of, and I'm putting some of these words in his mouth, but wash over him a little bit. I was wondering about the theories, the various theories of emotion or affects and harmony, and the way that literally does play out in lives, in a lot of experiences. And it seems like it seems like he's getting at that a little.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, barbershop quartet has a lot of diminished harmonies typically that are dissonant, but then they resolve really sweetly. That's definitely something that he can, Rhapsody in Blue, I'm thinking of just a kind of the same concept with what we would call an appoggiatura or a suspension, just dissonances that are uncomfortable for a moment, but you know the resolution is going to come, and it's that anticipation that you really savor. You love the feeling of the anticipation, and then you savor the actual resolution when it does finally come.
And so, those are things that we would hear in these pieces of music that he shared with us.
I think so, yeah, for sure.
Harmonic tension, resolution, and the good feeling that gives us, which
that's
he
right.
just revels in.
That's right.
In talking
yeah.
about this.
Yeah, I mean, there's also to me in that list as well, some orchestrational, like he, clearly is responding to things that are kind of lush and full. He's not mentioning a Mozart piano sonata or just a jazz guitar solo or anything like that. It's all things that are very rich. The orchestration matches the richness of the harmony.
There was one other example that he gave that I didn't include in this shortened version, and it was the music of, I don't know if you know the artist, the recording artist, Mantovani.
I mean, I've heard the name. Okay. And
Mantovani was an orchestra,
yeah,
conducted by a gentleman named Mantovani. Big, huge,
right,
string orchestra that played these very lush arrangements of popular songs.
Right.
And he resonated with those pretty strongly.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, given the time period when he was growing up, that that definitely makes sense.
Do you think people, like, so now I'm asking you to maybe go a little beyond your expertise, but is it harmony, which this excerpt sort of is highlighting, or is it you're drawn to timbral, to orchestration, to the wash of the whole?
I wonder, because I was thinking this the same thing, but it has to be a combination, I think, because even if the harmony is not the driving force of the music, it still needs to be interesting enough. And really, it's the dissonances, the suspensions and the anticipations that come across so well with a big string orchestra or a quartet of voices where one person can hold the note of resolution while another person holds a dissonant note above it that then eventually resolves down, right? It's very difficult to make that happen with just an acoustic guitar or with a piano. And so it's these sustained instruments, violins, the strings in general, or voices. I think people think of that as harmony.
Right, right.
When really what they're talking about is the timbre or the orchestration as much as what the actual chords are that they're hearing.
But at the heart of this is also, you know, so it's the quartet or it's the one part of a larger orchestra that's able to hold, you know, the melodic instrument that's able to hold the pitches in tension and then to resolve, that speaks to music being something greater than the parts that, you know, the individual parts that bigger than the whole. I want to make a metaphor. This, you know, this is, and thus, and therefore, you know, all music makes the world better.
Well, and I mean, you know what, like, you know, there are evolutionary biologists probably would argue that voice, right, is the one instrument that we all carry around with us, and it's one of the instruments that can sustain, and so I think there's just a stronger, not that there's a stronger connection to vocal music, but music that has some sustain to it. I think it conjures up stronger emotional reactions in some ways.
That's cool.
I like that, but
this is fascinating.
Yeah.
So Tim is going to be really intrigued to hear about our conversation about his memories.
Well, that's great. I loved hearing his memories. That was fantastic. Yeah.
So let's move on to the next. Interview number two is also one that I conducted with a gentleman who's a musician, as you'll mention, he's a guitarist. And as a teenager, he had this really wonderful kind of enlightening experience about a certain type of music that really changed him in some significant ways. So let's listen next to Bruce Blackstone.
Well, my name is Bruce Blackstone. I'm 62 years old. I have been a lover of music my whole life and have always been involved in one way or another with music, including being a musician. My first most profound musical memory, being a child of the 70s and being completely enamored with the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. A family moves into the apartment next door. His name was Joel Deutsch. He's a couple of years older. And of course, it's like, hey, man, what bands are you into? Blah, blah, blah. I tell him, you know, Stones, Led Zeppelin. He's like, you know, what are your favorite songs, man? And I tell him these songs. And he says, dude, those are blues songs. They're the same. And I say, no, they're not. And he goes, go listen to them and we'll talk. I come back and I'm like, yeah, they have a predictability to them. They're all, I mean, now I know they're all 12-bar blues. Any musician who knows anything knows what a 1-4-5 is. 1-4-5, 12-bar blues. And so I kept listening to it until I finally got it. And it was really healing for me, because one of the things that I realized why I was so enamored of the blues, you can be listening to a blues recording you've never heard of, and you can feel when they're going to do a break. You can feel when the end comes. So there was this predictability to it, but also there was this deep emotionality to it that was very soothing and very healing for me.
Completely different story.
Mm-hmm.
About a completely different experience of music. And Don, any thoughts?
Yeah,
any
completely
thoughts on
different genre, right? And I don't know. I mean, I also have to wonder about the lives of people just in general. I mean, I don't want to take your podcast in a whole different direction, but I literally did not hear any classical music until I was 18 years old. So to listen to your first person, you know, talk about hearing Rhapsody in Blue at whatever age, or there's, you know, whatever led to that is socioeconomic situations or whatever play into what people's musical backgrounds are going to be. So that's one thing that comes to mind. In terms of the music itself, yeah, this is actually something I've kind of been thinking about. The Stones and Zeppelin being blues, and sure, yeah, so he mentions predictability, which gets back to what we were talking about before with anticipation. And so this is, you know, this is a person that it just sounds like he enjoys the predictability, and he said deep emotional soothing, right? So he puts it on, and it doesn't mean he loves it deeply, obviously, but it's a different kind of relationship with the music, or a different kind of desire that he wants to get out of the music. As a theorist, I would want to talk about the blues. Everyone says, yeah, the Rolling Stones, that's just blues. But I guess it depends what your definition of the blues. I mean, to me, the blues is a particular chord progression,
mm-hmm.
as well as lyrical structure and phrasing structure. And I'm sure there are Rolling Stone songs that follow that a lot, but I don't know that many that follow it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
My sense is that the earlier recordings of the Stones, Led Zeppelin, relied somewhat heavily on the blues, yeah, genre, the love of American blues, Chuck Berry, these great artists in the 50s.
So yeah. just as for context, the Rolling Stones began as a sort of not as an outward facing rock group, but as a blues, you know, it's just guys that got around and they tried to mimic the sound of old blues recordings, you know, and so they were sitting around and they recorded that, and there were clubs in London that facilitated them performing, and they precede, of course, the Led Zeppelin and Jimmy Page, who was able to exist on that sort of blues, you know, it could sound just like any blues record from America from the 30s, 40s, and 50s on guitar. But then they started recording, and it does become something else. So there are cases of Led Zeppelin's, you know, A Whole Lot of Love or something, a song that's like, you know, this is a cover song that, you know, that we could think of it nowadays. We think of it, oh yeah, it's a cover song. And what was interesting is for so many listeners, perhaps Bruce, but for so many listeners, they didn't know the original. So it wasn't a cover. It was sort of like, nope, this is it. You know, and to me, that was the case. I mean, I didn't know the original. I actually did know a couple of songs, but didn't even make the connection. Like, I knew about Robert Johnson, had a Robert Johnson record from when I was like 12 years old. And it was a decade or more before I realized that the Chicago, what's the good old Chicago, or
Sweet Home Chicago.
Sweet Home Chicago was a Robert Johnson song. Like, that was mind melting to me.
Sure.
Till, you know, like he did that in the 30s, and for me that was a Blues Brothers song.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, what is your definition of the blues?
Well, it's the same thing. It's this formal structure, that. Has so much expressive weight to it that there's something that it's a simple pattern that carries profound emotion that has been put in it, And has a particular context, you know, a historical context based in Black culture, going way back to Africa, and that is manifested in American popular music in a really profound way, but then keeps popping up and taking roots in new scenes and venues, so like the London scene that came in with the British invasion, came back to America with the British invasion and just really changed rock in the 60s.
Yeah. So two things have struck me right now. One is that Bruce, without realizing it at the time, at the age of 16, was latching onto a series of songs by a couple of different, happened to be British artists, that all had this thing in common that he didn't know. And it took his new next-door neighbor, a couple years old to him, who apparently had listened to enough music and studied it closely enough to realize what this was all about, to say to him, don't you get it? They're all the same song. Hmm. They just sound different from one another. And Bruce, on listening closely, kind of gets that. Oh, yeah, that's right. There's that chord. It goes up to that one. And there's a similarity. The other thing that impresses me, and I've been saying this for years, is that isn't it a marvelous thing that people keep recording the blues? How many blues songs have been recorded? How many tens of thousands? And people keep making this particular genre of music,
yeah,
even though it's pretty much 1-4-1-4-5-4-1 over 12 bars, again and again and again. There's something about that, that it can be remade so many different ways and so expressively that it's still here after all these decades and decades.
Yeah.
We're still listening to the blues with the same fascination.
No two are exactly the same.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a wonderful mold, you know, just like us, if you were a Mozart or a Haydn sitting down to write a symphony, it's like, okay, they didn't call it sonata form necessarily then, but they knew exactly what to do because that's what hundreds of other pieces already did.
It's a convention.
Exactly,
so to speak.
Right.
Yes, yeah, a musical
exactly
convention.
Right. And that's the kinds of things that we teach in our classes, is these are the conventions of this style, these are the conventions of that style. And it doesn't mean they have to be constrictive, but you should know about them before you start creating your own stuff.
And there's also an element here, and I mentioned the association between Robert Johnson and this one song, but there's also this reality that sometimes I find myself doing this, like there are songs that I really enjoy and love and miss basic details until somebody points it out, like, oh, of course.
Sure.
And then I'm like, oh, wait, yeah, that is just a, you know, nothing but a simple scale or whatever.
Right.
Or Eleanor Rigby's basically a two chord song. It's like, what? No, it is. Wait. Oh, yeah, you know, yeah, like yeah. Those observations that somebody else has to just sort of, have you ever found yourself experience like having just those something that just so basic about a song's structure?
Well, for me, it's always been lyrics. I'll listen to songs for years, decades before I listen to the lyrics, and I'll love a song for 40 years. I have many songs like this, and I'll one day say, "I think I'll listen to the lyrics," and I realize I've never listened to them, and that they add a whole new level of profound understanding and enjoyment for me to finally focus on the lyrics, because I'm listening to rhythm and texture and harmony and things like this.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm the same way with the lyrics for the most part. Yeah. Just starting to now become more aware of them and how intricate they can be.
Yeah. So let's listen to a third musical memory, and we're going to let Brian introduce this.
We're so grateful to Arizona Arts, who have introduced us to some musicians we might not have been able to interview otherwise, including David Harrington, who was so generous with his time that he gave us an extended 30, 45-minute interview that was so rich, and it contained so many musical memories. This particular musical memory from his longer interview is about a famous chord from a famous piece of music that inspired him to for his passion for string quartets.
I'm David Harrington, founder, violinist, artistic director with Kronos Quartet. I don't think I know any more about music than the next person. I think it is mysterious. How does it work? How does it work? As a musician, I've always relied on my musical memories and reference points of sound. Well, at age 12, I was reading a biography of Beethoven, and I'd come across the late quartets, and there was this kind of reverence for the late quartets. I had no idea what a late quartet was, right? So I thought, okay, I'm going to find out what a late quartet is. And I remember the moment I first heard the E-flat major opening chord of Opus 127, the first of Beethoven's late quartets. That's the first time I recall not having any choice, but I had to learn how to make that sound. No choice. It was so incredibly beautiful and human and thick and warm, and it just sounded right to me. I think what I'm hearing is the resonance of that chord. And I've listened to countless other recordings of that opening chord. I know the balance of the chord. I mean, it's just embedded in my heart. But it was that kind of power and intimacy of the E-flat major chord that I can hear that sound right now. I carry that with me every day.
Yeah, so that's a story about having a specific sound. Like he said, he carries it with him every day. And I'm primarily referring to the timbre of the first time he heard it, right?
The first recording, I believe from the context of the larger discussion, it was the first recording that he listened to that just drove him to mm-hmm. his great love. And in the longer version, he speaks of how that led him to want to be in a string quartet and to bring his friends around and gather the music and play through. they played
right.
through that.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's a motivation to, like, you need a community of people, right, to recreate what he wanted to recreate based on what he had heard. And so that's one element of it, that it wasn't something he could do on his own because it was from a quartet, and so he had to seek out others.
Let me ask a technical question. As a music theorist, is there something about an E-flat chord played in a certain configuration by a string quartet that has some magical resonance to it? Do you know? Is it the way the voicing of the chord in this particular writing by Beethoven?
I don't know, but it does strike me that so there's that piece. There's the Eroica Symphony that famously starts with two E-flat major chords, boom, boom. And then a couple decades later, maybe a few decades later, Wagner starts his four opera ring cycle with Das Rheingold, which, if you know, is it just, so the opening scene is just sort of these, I'm going to mess it up, but it starts with a long E-flat pedal, and long, five, it's very long, and it eventually arpeggiates this long E-flat major chord. I remember in grad school, me and some friends had a joke about E-flat major. We think Eruption by Eddie Van Halen is basically an E-flat. So it was like E-flat was, you know, sort of the center of the musical universe somehow. So it's a strange thing.
I'm going to ask a question, and I'll edit it out if it's a really stupid question later on. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is in what key? C minor?
Yeah.
Da 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 da. What is that note? Would that be an E-flat?
It is.
Yeah. From 5 down to the flat 3.
Right.
There's another E-flat at a pivotal opening of a piece of music.
Well, that's right, yeah. And at that point, the piece could easily be in E-flat major because all you've heard is...
That's a matter of some debate.
Exactly.
What do those three notes really suggest to us,
yeah,
harmonically, tonally speaking? Yeah.
Do you know one thing about his story that, that I'm responding to or that is making me think? He speaks of carrying this chord around with him, the balanced chord, knowing exactly, you know, how loud the cello needs to be in relation to the viola and the violins and the structure of that, and carrying that inside him. And I heard another story. An acquaintance of mine, Mary Lou Prince, was one of Nadia Boulanger's last students, and she told the story of her first meeting of Nadia Boulanger, and Nadia Boulanger sat at a piano well away from her and played something and wanted her to play it back, you know, just, and it was just the assumption that her ear would be good enough to play a complex, and so she could, and she said, but she could because she always carried an A440 with her, that was just something that she carried. And I asked this kind of to both of you as people who've thought a lot about earworms and stuff that sure sticks with you. You know, this idea of carrying a harmony with you or carrying a sound with you inside and the ability of that to be perfect, even for people without perfect pitch, is something which I don't believe David Harrington has. I don't believe I'm not sure if Mary Prince has or does not, but... What do you think about that?
I mean, if you're tuning to A440 throughout your whole life, you're going to have a lot of A4. You're going to have a pretty strong sense of what A440 is.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something about E flat being a tritone away from A440 that makes it stick with people. I have no idea. I feel like there are certain first chords, like he's talking about a first chord. Symphony of Psalms by Stravinsky has a first chord that's very famous. It's an E minor chord, but it's got, you know, more instruments are playing the chordal third G than any of the other notes. And so it's not orchestrated like you would a normal E minor chord. Hard Day's Night, that opening chord, right, is a real famous one that can stick in, you know. So I do think that first sonorities, I suppose, can be kind of like an earworm or a thing that you can definitely think about what it sounds like at any given moment.
Great. Yeah. The only other thing I wanted to comment on in listening to David Harrington's interview again is that here's a guy who's reading about Beethoven's early quartets at the age of 12.
Says
something about his future as a musician, right? At a very young age, he is into this.
No, for sure. I mean, and that, you know, that's, yeah, there are, when I was a TA at the Eastman School of Music, I had, you know, students who, yeah, for my 16th birthday, I got this George Crumb score, you know.
Right, like, yes.
Okay, yeah, great.
That's,
so, I mean, you
not,
know. That
not, was not my experience.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I do think that, you know, there's, I don't want to say that it's a whole other world because we can all love and experience music very deeply without being like a musical expert or savant or whatever.
I think also our generation, you know, we grew up in the 20th century pre-internet. And so we weren't able to just allow the internet to take us to wherever to hear literally anything at the click of a button in a way that many young people now are able to do that. So there's going to be a changed hearing from that, and that'll affect memory as well.
Yeah.
But David Harrington is just so precocious.
Yeah, So we want to express our thanks to Don Trout, professor of music at the University of Arizona School of Music, for being with us as our guest on this episode of our Lifetimes of Listening podcast. Don, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Always good to see you too, and thank you for sharing the fascinating stories from the work you've done. Keep it up.
Great. Thank you. Thanks. What's coming up on future episodes of Lifetimes of Listening? In upcoming episodes, we'll talk with several accomplished musical performers about their most important musical influences, performers, recording artists, mentors that have inspired them to become better musicians. And we have some other themes that are emerging from the archive, including the theme of musical memories about homesickness.
We've also found that some of our interview subjects, have shared with us things about specifically musical memorials, occasions on which music has connected them to a loved one that they've lost, perhaps. So those topics and others that we're still considering in future editions of Lifetimes of Listening.
So how can you get involved? Well, first, start by going to our website, musicalmemories.music.arizona.edu. You can also Google Lifetimes of Listening, and it should pop up in many cases. Where you can submit a musical memory of your own through a sound file, through a written description. You can also ask us to set up an appointment where we would record you in person. You could also suggest a person that you would like us to reach out to and ask them about a musical memory. Thank you for being with us today. I'm Brian Moon.
And I'm Dan Cruz, and that's this installment of Lifetimes of Listening, the Arizona Musical Memory Archive and Podcast. Thanks for being here.
The executive producer of Lifetimes of Listening, the Arizona Musical Memory Podcast, is Brian Moon. The program is produced and edited by Dan Cruz. The Lifetimes of Listening website was created by Cynthia Barlow, Principal Information Technology Manager with the University of Arizona Fred Fox School of Music. Music is from Zapsplat.com and from Pixabay.com. Special thanks to the Fred Fox School of Music for hosting our website and UA Marketing and Communications for helping us launch this project, the archive, and this podcast series. For more information and to get involved in our research, visit musicalmemories.music.arizona.edu. This is Lifetimes of Listening, the Arizona Musical Memory Podcast.